It is an early morning at the Coalition on Homelessness. Chance Martin, the editor of Street Sheet, is busy dispatching vendors of the street newspaper for homeless people. He shuffles through paperwork while bagging the next bundle of newspapers between sips of coffee. Here the realities of street life are left on the door early, as Chance resolves a conflict with the street vendor who has lost his child to Child Protective Services.
Oh. You're homeless. You shouldn't have a care in the world, bro. Yeah, I'd be stressing too. CPS has her now?
Yeah.
You know, if you ever want to write about this anonymously, you know, like dealing with CPS and trying to get your kid back and losing your kid because you're homeless. Fucking A, that would be a great story. You know, because that's an issue that homeless families are doing that nobody knows about. Nobody, you know, and CPS is like, it's like so unaccountable because CPS is formed under a federal mandate and they're federally funded, right?
Yeah.
So they figure they got the biggest dick in town to swing around, right? And and they'll just intervene for no reason at all.
They want to terminate our parental rights.
What is? Okay.
Yeah. So we're really stressing, you know. We're trying to take care of it. We'll probably have to do a program.
Oh, substance abuse program?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
In-house. But whatever it takes, you know, so we can get her back.
Yeah, well, yeah, do it.
Yeah, we see her twice a week. We see her tomorrow again.
Yeah.
Did you see the pictures?
Yeah.
She's a cute baby.
She'll be a year old in 9 days.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
All right, Chris.
Appreciate it.
Thank you, man.
You're welcome.
9 days. That is the
oldest. So, Chance.
There's a slice of reality for you.
Yeah.
What is the what are you doing here?
I'm doing the street sheet distribution. Basically we raise all the money to print and we raise all the money to print and produce the street sheet. And we provide it free to any homeless person that wants to vend it as a way of supplementing their income or making survival income. Or as we like to tell the more mainstream people, it's a dignified alternative to panhandling.
These are the realities for Americans not only living through poverty, but also homelessness. The Coalition is the Tenderloin. Chance took us on a tour of the Tenderloin so we could see firsthand what life is like there.
So what neighborhood is this?
We're kind of on the Civic Center end of the Tenderloin. This has historically been, as far as law enforcement policy goes, a containment zone for nuisance crimes, which is pretty much vice and drugs. Street level drug sales, survival sex, gambling, you know, the kind of things that you really can't extinguish from any kind of vibrant society, but, you know, the good people get outraged about it, so you corral all the activity in the one neighborhood where the poorest people in town live, where the most disempowered people in town live, where they have the least voice to impact public policy to make it a better place to live.
So they concentrate all the poverty in one space and contain it.
Yep.
Transforming it or trying to fix it.
Correct. And then when it gets so bad, when you have a situation like the Chronicle and an Examiner railing on a near daily basis about homelessness and poverty and the associated perception of crime in the mid-market area, then when developers come in and say, hey, we have a block or we have a plan here to level 4 square blocks of this stuff and put up another tourist megaplex or a 20-screen IMAX theater, the people all sigh in relief and say, wow, they cleaned up that neighborhood. And then it just goes to the next place where poor people live.
So I see a lot of working types of families, immigrant families here.
A lot of families, a lot of immigrant families, doubled and tripled up in some of these apartments around here. You know, most of the remaining SRO hotel units are centered in this neighborhood. Most of the substandard housing in San Francisco is centered in this neighborhood. That's why it's cheaper. This is it.
The Tenderloin is just one of the areas in San Francisco plagued by generations of poverty and the associated ills that come along with economic underprivilege. San Francisco's Bayview Hunters Point is another area that has come under increasing economic devolution. I spoke with a longtime resident of Bayview and publisher of the San Francisco Bayview News, Willie Ratcliffe.
We're here in a predominantly African-American neighborhood of San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
As you look out your window here, you're looking out onto the street of your neighborhood. What strikes you first about this neighborhood?
Neglect.
Neglect?
Neglect, economic and environmental racism that running high here. Kids standing on the corners, got no jobs, and makes me think about the shipyard that's poisoning our people. We got a lot of people dying from cancer and other respiratory disease and suffering from asthma, and plus we have the power plant over here that contributes. We have the sewer treatment plant, which handles 80% or better of all the sewer in San Francisco.
The Coalition on Homelessness here says 40% of the homeless people in San Francisco are African American.
We'd say it's more than that. There's a lot of them they don't even know about. You know, it used to be we weren't the leading in homelessness because of people owning their houses out here. But it just got worse and worse with no jobs, see. For African Americans, the most of them wind up down around 6th Street, you know, in that area down there. But it used to not be any homeless people out here. Because people made room for their people if it was in the garage or wherever, you know, they had somewhere to sleep. But, it, you know, it just got so bad that when we had the biggest boom this city ever had, and then the increase in homelessness of African Americans and gentrification of African Americans that pushed them out of here really outlined what the underlying problem was that nobody don't want.
Many have written about the causes of neighborhood decline. While we may think that it is a question of morals or social deprivation, most people see it as a direct consequence of economic and civil planning by business and government officials. After the closing of the war on poverty by the Reagan administration, America's viewpoint on the poor changed from one of understanding to one of blame.
Well, the perception is that, you know, okay, deep background. The Heritage Foundation, which is a right-wing think tank under the direction of former Attorney General Ed Meese, came out with a policy paper some years ago called Broken Windows. And what it is, that was basically the genesis of what we call quality of life laws. The broken windows analogy is that if you have a part of town where there's graffiti, where there's broken windows, it's going to breed more crime. So basically, in Broken Windows terminology, a homeless person sitting on the corner or panhandling or sleeping on the sidewalk or urinating or defecating in public or having an open container in public is a broken window. And they especially target those types of nuisance crimes with the idea that they're going to improve the quality of life in that neighborhood. There's also a perception that widespread visible homelessness adversely affects local businesses.
Yet this viewpoint is not only local, it is international. Under the guise of corporate globalization, yet critics of globalization say that exporting jobs to cheap labor markets is a leading factor to the unraveling of the social fabric here in America. Kevin Danaher of Global Exchange.
Impacts your life. In my recent book, I've got a whole chapter about the impact on the U.S. economy. This is for people who don't give a damn about Africa, Asia, Latin America, whatever. They say, to hell with that. I only care about here. Okay, you only care about here? Let's look at the data. What the data shows is that the average U.S. worker is making less now than they were making 25 years ago. They're working more hours now than they were 25 years ago, even though they're making less. The country's in debt up to its eyeballs, about $6 trillion. The interest on the federal debt last year was $400 billion. That's bigger than the Pentagon. And that money's going upward in the global class structure because that U.S. Treasury Department debt is owned by Japanese banks and British insurance companies, and a lot of it's leaving the country. But you're paying it out of your taxes. Now let's go back 25 years to where it was Nixon, actually. The Nixon administration was the one that initiated these so-called free market policies. Remove barriers to U.S. companies moving their capital out of the country. Lower the tariffs, that is, taxes on products crossing borders. Notice they use a code word, they call it tariffs. The treaty underlying the WTO is called the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. Well, a tariff is a very specialized tax that's only paid by transnational corporations because it's when you move product across border. So they wanted to move their manufacturing out of the United States to places where they could pay workers a dollar a day. Because obviously you can make bigger profits if you're producing your stuff with workers getting paid a dollar a day, no trade unions like in China, destroy the environment, weaker environmental controls, etc. But you got a problem. If you go outside the U.S. and produce that, and then you're going to pay high taxes when you bring it back in the United States, that kind of undercuts the whole point of it. So they lobbied both internationally and within the U.S. Congress, and they got a lowering of the tax rate. And I have those charts in my book, too, showing how the tax rate on the corporations has plummeted. The tax rate on us individuals has gone up, but the tax rate on these biggest corporations has gone down. That made it easier for them to move the manufacturing base out of the United States. So when I was a kid coming out of high school, right, in the late 1960s, you could get good paying jobs that you could actually support a family on one paycheck. That doesn't exist anymore because those good manufacturing jobs left the country. And I'll give you just one statistic that shows how severe this is. The United States, as a nation, imports more computer equipment and electronics from China than China buys from the United States. Now, on the surface, you say, wait, that couldn't be right. No, it's right. But it's not about China. It's Dell, Compaq, Macintosh, Intel, Hewlett-Packard. They move their factories from the United States to places like China. Of course, they want to sell the stuff back here because we still have money, right, to pay for it, whereas in a lot of those third world countries, workers don't. So talk about patriotism. The leaders of this country are the most unpatriotic. They're more unpatriotic than any kid out burning a flag in the street. That's symbolic. These guys actually gutted the country's economy, got the country into debt. The U.S. federal government debt is over three times the size of all third world debt combined. So where does the United States come off telling these third world countries, hey, you're in debt, you're running your country bad, you got to do what we say? People aren't idiots. They see this outside the United States. They say, you give hypocrisy a bad name. You know, this is crazy. We're not going to listen to you. So there's a legitimacy crisis as well. And that's one of the reasons why people resent us. But even if you don't care about that, just in terms of our standard of living here, it's declining because of the way these guys are running the country. They don't care about the United States. They care about their bank accounts and their global investors. So they'll gut the entire U.S. economy.
The issue of displacement and poverty are deeply intertwined. In San Francisco, one of the major issues during the economic boom of the dot-com phase was the issue of gentrification. Willie Ratcliffe has seen the same gentrification issue affect his community.
Fillmore, they ran everybody out of there. You know, 200 businesses, 5,000 homes got destroyed. And then the redevelopment agents admitted that their policy was to remove black people out of San Francisco. They were getting a little too powerful, too many of them. You know, and they're too clannish.
Either they want to just bypass this neighborhood and not really make it?
No, the big developers want it. They want the neighborhood. This is still San Francisco, and actually it's the most, it's the best part of it. Earthquake, we have no problem with the earthquake. We're living on rocks out here. You know, you can get right on 3rd Street and look downtown. You know, so it, that's what's happening is the big developers want it. Some of the largest developers in the country wants to grab up this land and develop. They want to develop 3rd Street and run us off of here. We own 3rd Street now. We own the land. We ain't just here renting. You know, these buildings are owned by black people. Just like the largest percentage of home ownership in this city is out here. And that's because of ownership by black people. See, that's the only thing they let them own, and damn it, they went and done that. Out of the little money they was making at the shipyard, all of them went and bought houses when they were cheap out here. And most of them are paid for. Some people got a lot of equity. You know, there's nothing to find people in that little old bank down the corner. Got $200,000-$300,000 in there, plus the house paid for. So we got a lot of wealth out here, but it's not being.
The problem is not just a matter of redevelopment agencies, realtors, and greedy landlords. It extends even to public policy, as Chance Martin explains how housing projects are slowly gentrified.
So we have people that make $40,000 a year eligible for public housing. What it works out to is the people that are displaced, only about a third of them are eligible to move back in to the new project that replaced the old project. And that's why we have a disproportionate amount of African Americans in our homeless population. African Americans in San Francisco, demographically, we're losing our African American population. I think from the 90 census to the 2000 census, we lost about 2% of our African-American population. Meanwhile, if you look at our homeless population demographically, 40% of them are African-American. So, you know, there is an inherent racism in these kinds of federal policies. Yeah.
The repetitive theme of capitalizing at people's expense by corporations is repeated not only in traditional business sectors, but is now being exported to public services, such as the prison system. The latest sector to come under capital control is the homeless industrial complex. Chance Martin explains this phenomenon.
Make some killer profits off this started showing up. As soon as the Fed started funding homeless services, that was like the signal that the gravy train is on. And people that were politically connected, people who saw the opportunity to rake in big contracts started popping up. Some are provided by private contractors. The majority are provided by private contractors.
So it's good for business to increase the temporary solution than a permanent solution.
Well, yeah, and two, it's... It's always an advantageous thing for people who are out to make a profit to have
readily available source of casual labor. But, you know, I tend to look at homelessness in San Francisco, you know, the reason why we don't build more affordable housing and get these people off the streets, you know, is because that too many jobs now are contingent on those homeless people. The local homeless services industry, there's a lot of corruption there. There's a lot of shelter managers and program managers making exorbitant salaries. There's a lot of contracts, you know, short-end contracts that are awarded on a buddy system. None of this, you know, all of this makes it more expensive to provide these services, and none of them provide the first enhancement to the services that we're offering to homeless people. So then, you know, the homeless situation naturally in that climate becomes exacerbated, and the business owners yell, you know, the Chronicle can't tell the truth about the corruption in this mayoral administration, so who do they blame? The victim. It's very neat. It's very fascist.
The cycle of corruption runs very circular in the San Francisco homelessness services scene. Chance explains how the government will give money to one nonprofit organization with exorbitant salaries, and that money will be funneled back into political dirty tricks.
Of Walden House, which is undeniably the largest provider of substance abuse treatment services in San Francisco. I pulled their 1999 IRS 990 up and found out that Alfonso Alcamporo, who is the executive director there, in addition to about $100,000 annual salary and an expense account of about $10,000 to $15,000, also paid another $100,000 in 1 year into his retirement account. Not surprisingly, Alfonso Alcamporo is very connected with the mayor, is very connected with the courts, is awarded city contract after city contract. There was some speculation that there might have been some malfeasance in a recent election that we had, where one of the initiatives in that election was the stadium bond vote. There was allegations of ballot box stuffing, and it seemed very eerie because every questionable circumstance when it came to ballots involved somebody from Walden House who was a volunteer. Nothing was ever proved. The story was dropped out of the press like a hot rock, and later that year, Mayor Willie Brown gave Walden House $3 million in discretionary funds.
With so much corruption and money and public interest at stake, one would think that the media would be critical of this industrialization of public services and human resources. The Chronicle newspaper is the main source of public criticism for the San Francisco community. But the Chronicle is also a corporation. It should be noted that the Chronicle owns over 22 buildings within the district of the Tenderloin, an area which they are propagating to be gentrified. Chance Martin explains the Chronicle and its impact on local thought on homelessness.
We know that the Chronicle has a building down on 6th Street.
Yeah.
What is the relationship to the Chronicle's inability to portray homeless people in a fair and decent light, and to their ownership of a building in a poor neighborhood that they want to redevelop?
Well, I think it's disingenuous to approach the Chronicle as the Chronicle. All right, we're talking about the Hearst Corporation, and the Hearst Corporation has vast media holdings, you know, magazines, television stations, newspapers, and I think the Chronicle is carrying on the fine Hearst tradition, you know, of yellow journalism, you know, except instead of targeting, you know, in the case of yellow journalism, a minority, which was our Chinese immigrants, you know, we're targeting people who are economically disadvantaged, and by virtue of that, have to conduct their lives in a different manner than the rest of society. The Hearst Corporation is very influential. There's a lot of stuff that came out in the Examiner trial that basically said that Tim White, you know, at the Examiner and then the Chronicle as they acquired it, that they cut a deal with Mayor Willie Brown that he would help facilitate the acquisition of the Chronicle and the sale of the Examiner to the Fang family, for the Chronicle laying off charges of corruption in the Brown administration. All of a sudden there's an absence of any reporting on corruption in the Brown administration. And when
Chance Martin is not alone in his skepticism of the Chronicle's ability to report the facts accurately and objectively. Willie Ratcliffe expresses a similar doubt in the following.
Why doesn't the rest of San Francisco ever hear about what's going on in these neighborhoods? Is the Chronicle just ignorant, or are they purposely ignoring the issues?
Purposely ignoring. The Chronicle, like the Chronicle, is part of the problem. They are one of the big corporations that throws their weight around, and will not. In other words, they stick with the other big corporations and not bringing out anything that's going to make them look bad. If we're suffering, we want to move whatever roadblocks is in our way, and we're not particularly about who it is or what color they are or any of the other things. We want some justice for our community to be stopped being discriminated against, stop being profiled, stop being thrown in prison because lack of jobs. Our biggest problem is economic and environmental racism practiced by government and private industry. All government and private industry.
Poverty, racism, homelessness, intertwined in the capitalist system. In the preceding, you have been listening to some of the voices of ordinary people doing what they can to make life better for their neighbors. But the struggle isn't just limited to these voices. In this series, Poverty in America, we will be bringing more voices, and we will be bringing the voices of those fighting poverty wherever it is, and the agents who bring poverty to our communities.
All those people who can come together and express not only their dissent, but their contempt for governments that allow this to happen, and their contempt for governments that allow it to continue.
Exploitation is going on. There's always been resistance. And that resistance, in Chomsky's analysis, is that it comes from indigenous population. It always has.
To media.iww.org. Media for the one big union of all the people.